Hey, everybody, welcome back to Watching Westworld. We've got a little bit of a different format this week. Jim and I are going to be putting to bed season three of Westworld. It's in the books. We're going to be putting it down until season four. And joining us this week is Kim Renfro from Insider. If you are at all practicing any kind of awareness of Westworld online and you're listening to this podcast, it's a pretty good bet you are. You probably have heard of Kim and her famous, comprehensive, exhaustive list of the Westworld timeline encompassing all three seasons. It's color-coded for seasonality. It's illustrated with characters' faces so you don't get lost. It's been a really invaluable guide for the last two seasons or so of Westworld. Plus, she also is providing the kind of backbone of this podcast in her 31 or 33 unanswered questions, Kim?
I landed with 31, but hey, I'm sure we can find more.
it's her 31 unanswered questions remaining from Westworld season three as kind of an outline for the show. Kim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back. I'm glad to talk Westworld with you too.
Yeah, I think this is the first time we've been like Game of Thrones exclusive, but now we're dipping into the universes. It's very exciting. Let's start off by going kind of like in a round table. Let's exchange kind of, we're going to go like three rounds of what is the burning question that you want an answer from Kim's list. And again, you can, if you want to read more about Kim, you can find her on Twitter. You can find her in her column on Insider. I'm going to link all that stuff for everyone's convenience in the show notes. Kim, what's your most burning question left over from the finale of Westworld?
I mean, I have to go straight to that final post-credit scene and just what the heck did Bernard find when he entered the Sublime? And kind of like tandem with that, what made him power down and then wake back up? I'm just like, Jeffrey Wright is so good and I would watch him basically do anything on my TV screen, but those expressions that he had just were like perfectly cryptic enough where I'm like, are you excited? Are you awed? Are you surprised? What are you looking at? And so that's my numero uno.
It's very dusty. I know that
so dusty.
I definitely read awe in that expression right before he goes to sleep.
Yeah. And what I think I did see one person kind of like triggered this chain of thought in my mind in a Reddit post of like, they pointed out that earlier in the season they established that time moves faster in simulations for hosts than it does in the real world. So like, and obviously we know that he's not looking back at like a grassy pristine field with like a bunch of hosts just sitting around with tents. Like, so what, like, I'm just wondering how advanced of a like society, what kind of structures would they have built by now? Do they have an entire like city, like mecca type thing happening for hosts in there at this point? So that would translate to me for him being like awed by like looking at this like super advanced world that the hosts might have already built for themselves in there.
Yeah, it could be like a Zion to the real world's, you know, matrix kind of thing. Thing I was thinking when you talk about how much time has elapsed, and you can tell from the disintegrated cactus and the layer of dust and disrepair in the room, it's been probably years, if not many, many years. But yeah, the idea that simulations can proceed much faster than the real world, you know, what could he have spent that much time in? And did time like slip his mind, or did he consciously make the decision to apparently let Stubbs rot after promising he was going to fix it? You know, I'm going to take a quick dip in the Sublime and then come right back and fix you up, pal.
And how fast does time move comparatively? You know, is it something on the order of 10 times? Is it 100 times faster? Does it depend on, you know, kind of dovetailing with my burning question, where did Loras send the host data? Does it kind of, you know, run faster depending on what computer system it's in or where it's at?
Yeah, unfortunately, she could only send it to a Nokia brick phone from the night. She wanted to ensure it survives above all else.
I mean, she says, where humans can't access it. So I guess, like, nobody's using those old phones, right?
Yeah. So, and you know, if, it can run at a pretty good clip unless someone's playing Snake, and then just the frame rate crashes. That's a great. Yeah, I don't. Do you have any, like, because the one thing is, like, me and Jim had this joke that we had on the last podcast where it's like, what if someone comes back out that's not Bernard? And then we kind of had this, like, elaborate, like, you know, Bernard's essentially Uber for, like, people in the Sublime that want to have unfinished business in the real world and just kind of, like, take his body for a ride. And, you know, they make their peace with Holoris or whatever, and they come back, and or you know, Maeve's daughter can visit her and Bernard's body. But it is, like, you know, what they taught us last year, that when someone puts on that halo, like, their consciousness, like, completely leaves their body. It's game over. Like, there's an empty marble in there, which you can presuppose that, like, someone could ride back. So are we entirely certain Bernard is the thing waking up in the hotel room?
Well, what's interesting is I don't necessarily think that. I think that there was a difference in what happened when he put on the halo in, like, that, like, mini halo in this episode versus what happened when him and Dolores, like, stood in those kind of, like, bigger mechanisms to enter the forge in season two. Like, they were standing up and, like, their bodies weren't powered down in the way that he seemed to, like, shut off and kind of, like, slump over.
In the same way the host, when they tumbled over the edge of the cliff after they stepped in, like, it seemed like that was, like, a rapture type thing.
Yeah.
Although,
so,
I wonder...
So they're distinct, right? Like, the Forge was not exactly the same thing as the Valley Beyond. The Valley Beyond is where the hosts go, or the right. Sublime is where the hosts go. The Forge was where a lot of the human data was stored, and the, like, they were touring, right. You know, the stuff with Logan and the library and all that. So maybe right, there's a different right, effect right. depending on that.
That's
yeah, it was like the Sublime was inside the Forge, but then Dolores separated it out and sent it away.
Yeah.
Is that, like, how that seemed to work?
Because I always thought that, like, the Forge and the Sublime were essentially two different Minecraft worlds. Like, it was running on the same platform, same technology. It's just, like, you know, a different instance of the same thing. But I don't, like so many other things in this technical details of show, that's just my headcanon. You know, there's nothing that I can point to the screen and say, oh, well, yeah. It's just, you know, humans are lazy and they reuse code. And
I think it seems significant that Bernard did not intend, like, when he put that headset on, he wasn't intending to leave Stubbs forever, and then he somehow did, and that seems to indicate to me that, like, something went, like, that expression of awe was on his face, and then it feels like something went wrong that causes him to straight up power down and leave Stubbs forever, or for a very long time in that bathtub with his ice. I interpreted it.
Could it be that maybe he doesn't need Stubbs anymore, because at that point he's kind of, you know, programmed Stubbs to be his bodyguard, and he served his function if he gets him to the Sublime, perhaps. So maybe he just decides, well, you know, Stubbs has taken this journey and he's helped me get where I need to be, and so Stubbs is expendable.
That's so cold-blooded.
I know.
It did fine with his treatment of Stubbs. I mean, that was one of the weird WTF moments throughout the season, is how cavalier Bernard was about, you know, treating a fellow sentient robot.
Yeah.
It's kind of, that'd be the next logical conclusion, just and which, you know, goes back to, where is Bernard good or evil? Is Maeve good or evil? Is Dolores good or evil? It probably depends on, you know, what your point of view, I guess.
Yeah.
Do you have any, like, solid ideas? Like an actual, did you see any theory that, like, anyone put forth that seemed, like, more interesting than others as far as this question of what he found in the Sublime?
I haven't, aside from that one that was pointing out that, like, time moves faster.
Yeah.
That was the one that I kind of latched onto, and then I haven't been digging too much around what other people are guessing. I feel like this is one of those questions that I really love thinking about, and yet I'm like, there's no way. I don't even know if, like, Nolan and Joy know what's in there yet. I feel like it's one of those things that they put in there as a stinger. I'm also, and maybe this is too much of a tangent, but I'm like, the fact that they didn't know they were getting a fourth season until, like, halfway through this season, I feel like they probably recorded both of those post-credit scenes and then weren't positive that they were going to lock those into the finale until after they had the season four confirmation news. So I feel like they like filmed themselves some like runway for like what they would do if they were leading into a fourth season, but it wasn't planned out to the point that there's anything that we can fully grasp onto to tell us for certain, if that makes sense.
It's how a lot of shows get written, but do you think that they have a definitive, because that makes a lot of sense, because before the end credits, like, this was a fully self-contained story. It's exactly like the first Matrix. It ends on kind of a positive, hopeful, but chaotic note, you know? But like, you could end it there and everyone could say, like, no one would be like, well, it's an incomplete story. It always scares me, though. It's one thing for like Vince Gilligan to not know exactly what he's going to do next season of Breaking Bad, because he has the overall arc. I'm telling Mr. Chip's going to Scarface, and that's the North Star I'm guiding toward. Do you have a feeling that Nolan and Joy have that kind of like definitive, this is the statement we want to make with Westworld, this is where we want humans and AI to be at the end, or are they trying to figure this out as they go?
I do think that they have that larger picture. Yeah. Sorted out in their minds, but I think that the little subplots of how they get there are not set in stone. Like, when I'm pretty convinced, and I can't remember now off the top of my head if they've spoken to this or not, but like, they did not know that Dolores had copied herself at the end of season two, you know? Like, I think that they set up that bag of pearls as like their next, like the next runway for season three, but they hadn't decided who was in them yet. And so I think it might be similar here, where like, they know Bernard is entering the Sublime, but they don't necessarily know like what's going on in there yet to a T.
Well, building your meta narrative though, like if they thought that season three might be all they got, the fact that that ended on somewhat a hopeful idea note, which is a human and an AI, Maeve and Caleb, were working kind of uncertainly, but in unison, that might be a hint towards the overall, because I was honestly worried coming into the season that like, man, maybe Nolan and Joy just fucking hate humans and they bought it's no free will theory and we're all a bunch of shit bags and this is going to be just look, it's like kind of rubbing our collective noses in our own, you know, shit and piss. But I feel like that I don't worry about that as much. This season is a lot more optimistic and hopeful than I just laid out.
Yeah, I totally agree. I was at, it's kind of crazy that the last like social thing I did out in the world was go to the Westworld season three premiere. Wow. That's pretty cool. And Nolan and Joy, they had like a little prepared speech before the episode, and Lisa Joy made this comment where she was like, I'm trying to remember exactly what she said, and I think I wrote about it, but she was effectively like, the world is a mess right now, and frankly, Westworld has nothing good to say about it. And everybody in the room laughed, and I was sort of like, oh God, that's dark. Like, I was like, am I really about to sit down and watch like a TV show that's purely just about how like humans are beyond repair and like there's nothing that we can do anymore and robots might as well run the world? And so I also was very pleasantly like surprised and happy that we got that optimism in the finale. So I do think that has to be part of their larger plan for what they're trying to say with the story, because like, we start out in season one with Ford and Arnold feeling like such misanthropes, you know? And I think part of the point is that we're seeing that humans aren't all bad, even if we've done a lot of terrible things in this timeline.
That's one of the things that excites me most, I think, about the future of Westworld, is the idea that we might get to see, you know, Nolan and Joy's sort of vision for the future world. And, you know, whether or not it's one of chaos and destruction, or whether it's one of peace and harmony, it's still kind of up in the air. And it's sort of like in the humans' court at this point. Like, do we want to fight them to the death and potentially and likely be eliminated? Or do we want to, you know, sit down at the table and talk with them and figure out what a world together looks like. And I'm super excited because with, you know, all these sort of flash forwards that we see in the post-credit sequence, you start to think, okay, they could take this show really far into the future, and we could see the kind of societal changes that might need to take place for that to happen, for that harmony to come about. And I don't really think I've seen a show that goes that far into the future with its speculation and with its sort of world crafting. And that is super exciting to me, that we might go, you know, hundreds, thousands maybe of years into the future and get to see what they think the world will look like.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I like, of anyone who's making TV right now or like sci-fi movies and that sort of thing, like I'm most at attention for what Nolan and Joy have to say, I think, about not only like current technology, but yeah, exactly, for like what the far future, like the way that humanity might be shaped in, yeah, hundreds of years to come. Absolutely.
All right, Jim, let's use this to pivot to your first unanswered question. What are you wanting to know?
It sort of dovetails with Bernard and what he saw in the Sublime, because I want to know where Dolores sent this host data. Because the thing that she says about it seems almost impossible to me, which is, I'm sending them and their world to a place no one will ever find them. There's no coming back now, no passage between their world and ours. And I don't know if that quote is meant to simply describe the fact that Bernard has the encryption key and so nobody can access this world without it, or if that's meant to say that wherever I'm sending them, the humans have no ability to access it whatsoever. But she doesn't really say that, right? She says no one will ever find them. There's no coming back and no passage. So like, it seems to indicate some bigger divide between the Sublime and the world of humanity.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think we answered it in broad, you know, we at least know it's on Nokia 1999 era brick phone.
Right. But where is that phone? Whose pocket is it in?
Yeah, and how do you, because like, I was kind of blown away that he just puts on this halo. He's got this case, he puts on a halo, and he can just commune with it, implying that it's like some kind of, it's not just a physical place, but it's like some kind of protocol that's listening, like a satellite or something. I mean, how do you get that? How is something, it's not easy to have a worldwide network that's like always like bidirectionally listening. But I don't know, like, I guess if I heard that a AI put like some kind of ridiculous, you know, 2000 character encryption system on something and there's only one copy of the key and it's gone, like that could be like if, for example, you have a Bitcoin wallet and you did that, you put a 2000 character password at random and you encrypted all your Bitcoins and you didn't write down the password, you could comfortably say that that wallet has now been lost, right?
Yeah, so it's interesting to me because Ciroc this season is sort of maybe an indication of this. He's looking, I think, for the encryption key, not the data itself. So does that say that he knows where the data is, that it's somewhere in either Delos systems or somewhere in Insight systems, perhaps Rehoboam itself? Or am I reading too much into that?
She also she typed in coordinates, which back in season two, that pinged a satellite to me, and with like that, you know, the like laser that's really just four lasers machine that they pointed up at the sky kind of thing, where I was like, okay, like I assumed that she was sending it to some like secret, you know, Delos Forge project satellite that like if only three people at Delos even knew it existed, how would anybody else know? Which I guess leads into like Ciroc having mold in the company, so he would know.
Yeah,
but it does, like, yeah, when Bernard put on that headset, I was like, is that literally it? Like, is it in that suitcase? Uh-huh. Or is that just his uplink mechanism to it? Yeah, I'm deeply confused about, like, what kind of technology.
Yeah, I said it can't be because, like, the Forge is such a massive project and, like, a massive facility. But then again, we know that, like, all of the Forge data fit comfortably on Peter Abernathy's skull marble, you know, not maybe not comfortably because he was going insane because of the data seeping out of his ears, but like it's still that's right. An incredibly dense amount of data to hold. So if you're talking about holding the consciousness of a few thousand hosts, maybe you could put something in the size of that kind of weird halo visor. But that's where like the lines of how the technology work in the show are just so blurry. It's like I'm not used to this hard of a science fiction show that defies you to like do kind of contextual analysis just by looking at things and understanding how they work in the real world, because
well, wait until we start talking about devs.
Yeah, no shit. No shit. But like, yeah, when I saw that Li-Fi cannon shoot them into space last season, I thought, oh yeah, the same thing. There's some secret Death Star project that's just inhabited. But also, satellite could just be some kind of mesh communications network, and that's just the first step of many right. Points till it gets to its destination. Who the hell knows? Since you can fit all of robot history into a pearl the size of a golf ball, there's no reason to say that it couldn't just exist in that briefcase, but I don't know. Is there any buyers on the theory that maybe it's inside, it was something inside Rehoboam or Solomon?
I don't know if there are buyers on that theory. I don't think I'm one, because we've seen people access Rehoboam's data, right? Dolores does it to get Serac's files. You can definitely get to that information, so that doesn't seem to fit the label that she puts on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it's again encrypted data, so it's just like, you know, you can access it the same way you can access an encrypted drive on a hard drive. Either you have the key or it's just random data. Okay.
But that doesn't square with her like wanting the final strategy to be Rehoboam deleting itself or Solomon corrupting. Because then she I don't think that she would risk the Sublime's data being on the same like system that she's actively trying to destroy.
And it seems too close to the human's grasp too. Like you wouldn't want it on a system that they're, you know, they designed and architected. It almost feels to me like she probably sent it to some kind of sanctuary computer, like the house that Arnold built so long ago, and they would have access to it there. But even then, that doesn't seem like that guarantees
found that house.
Right. That doesn't seem to be secret enough.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to my first burning question, which is, what is Shaloris's plan? Okay, guys, talk me out of this theory. Dolores came out of Westworld hot to end humanity, to preserve AI life. She wanted vengeance. She wanted to, you know, protect all of her people from those who might hurt them. And do you guys agree with like her, she came out of Westworld wanting to destroy humanity?
Yeah, as far as they've explained it to us through the show and actions and scenes.
Right.
That's so, how. Yeah.
So she thought badly of that plan eventually, and perhaps even early on, but before, it was after she split her consciousness into the various host bodies. So Haloris was down with that plan, or Shaloris was down with that plan to destroy her humanity, but she had all these interactions with decent, innocent people. She even saw like the softer side of Hale herself. You know, she really bonded with her fake family, and that kind of dealing with decent, innocent people changed her mind. But for whatever inscrutable AI reason Dolores had, she didn't tell any of her other copies that her goal had explicitly changed. So Haloris's family's deaths, you know, she talks about how that purged her of her weakness. But I think that actually cemented her break with Dolores, and now Haloris is running on a save all humanity plan that seems evil, just like Dolores's actual save and liberate humanity plan seemed all season long, but it's not going to work because it's going to be at total odds with Dolores's free humanity plan. Does that make any sense, or is that just sounding not like crazy?
I think it makes sense. I think that it's just being generous with explaining a kind of confusing and unexplained like motivation for both of those characters this season. Cause I didn't put this in my question slideshow, and maybe I should have, but I'm like, when exactly did Dolores change her tune? Because I'm unclear on when she went from humans can die and I don't care. I just want our kind to survive to, I guess some of them are fine and they should have a choice.
I am completely with you on this. I think like most of the season, I was very confused as to Dolores's motives because she wasn't talking to anybody. She wasn't saying what her motives were. She was proceeding along a path that seemed like the destruction of humanity, but suddenly at the end, it was not. It was our freedom. So, yeah, I'm right. with you. I was very confused.
Jim, I think that, Aaron, I think that's a great point in that, like, when she split herself, I think understanding what her mindset was when she copied herself is so important. And yet we don't. But I like that explanation that she must have changed her mind afterwards. And then the struggle that she was having with Shaloris all season was like getting this version of herself to be in sync with her when clearly that's not going to happen because they're having different experiences out in the world. And like, you know, it's this like nature versus nurture thing almost where like she made children of herself and then put them all in different situations. Uh-huh. And now she can't actually control how they feel about things or about her original ideas.
But she's also playing all of her cards really, like, that's why I said for inscrutable AI reasons, because it seems like she could just be 2 weeks, you know, after she splits and say, hey guys, turns out I've been doing a lot with these humans and it might not be their best idea to wipe them off. And then, you know, Musashi's like, I've just been dealing with the Yakuza. They're all assholes. No, we should totally go full on. Like, why wasn't there this like conversation? But I don't know, like maybe Dolores has got this kind of like free will thing. Like, she learned her lesson that you can't control copies of yourself, because if we extrapolate what she said to Maeve in the final episode, she could see Teddy as a copy of herself. So maybe she felt like the way that a parent might, you know, sometimes pigheadedly say, I can raise my child however I want, you know, it's none of your business. Maybe she kind of was rolling that way and saw how destructive it was with Teddy. So just because she has a change of heart, she doesn't feel like she can do anything to influence her children. I don't know.
It's going to be interesting in season 4, because I'm not sure I'm super excited to see like a larger scale rehash of the Maeve versus Dolores fight. If it turns out to be that, you know, Dolores and Dolores are not on the same page anymore, but are actually on the same page, they just don't know it. It's going to be an interesting season 4.
There's also something interesting about the inevitability of repeating cycles in history, because a lot of times when people change their political or developmental realities and like they completely change about, you know, how they are as a people, it's because they've had a lot of hard fought and won, you know, wisdom through years of lived experiences and going through some shit. And it's like, you know, it's like, oh, well, then I'll just, you know, you'll write this stuff down for future generations to take advantage of, and then they'll know better. But it doesn't seem to work that way, because people are born blank slates every fucking day and they have to go through those lived experiences to accumulate itself. So like, there is something interesting about like this inevitability that like you might want to avoid a societal collapse to get to some new level of human consciousness, but maybe you just can't. Like, you know, you got to have a revolution every once in a while to, you know, end feudalism, to, you know, in some way that we always did way to get to the next way. And like, you know, some kind of human AI hybridization would definitely be a revolution or a complete AI takeover. So maybe there's no way to peacefully exchange that power. And that's something that Dolores recognized. All right, Kim, round two. What is your second most burning question?
I guess this also connects in nicely. Where the heck are all the other Dolores copies now? So we obviously have Shaloris present and accounted for in Dubai, but we don't know where Dolores' copy is. The last time we saw him, he had a truck full of explosives. My best theory is that he's in part responsible for all those explosions that Maeve and Caleb were watching go off in buildings.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Maybe. And then we don't know if the Connell's Dolores pearl was destroyed or not, but the last time we saw it, Shaloris had like grabbed the sort of burned holder for it and taken it with her out of Delos, presumably. So she might have it, which means that she's in control of the second Dolores copy. And then the Musashi Dolores copy was last seen, the pearl is in the head of the Musashi host, and Clementine and Hanaro took that with them after they killed it. So
yeah, and we really
have going on, guys.
I got no idea where that Musashi head went and where, you know, Clementine and Hanaro went either. So
yeah,
maybe it's like
presumably so like it seems like maybe the Lawrence copy is like the new rogue Dolores agent, and then Connell's might be on team Shaloris going forward, and then the Musashi copy might be convinced to join Maeve slash now that Dolores wasn't actually trying to fight Maeve this whole time. They'll just stop fighting.
Dan and Dave completely contaminated the whole Westworld process, and they're essentially restaging the War of the Five Kings, only it's the War of the Five Pearls. And who's going to get the ultimate allegiance for the AI throne? But that's definitely going to be, you know, these are the big power pieces. Like Caleb is a past pawn, and maybe he's advanced to queen status by the end of the season. But like these other pearls are the other power pieces on the map, and winning them to your side is going to be a major coup. So probably a lot of season four is going to be, you know, there's a hostile takeover of the Dolores Enterprise, and we streamlined operations. Who's down with that? Who is left that actually understands like the original Dolores's program, and you know, because what Maeve's going to come out and just be like, oh no, Dolores is actually totally pro-human, saw beauty and everything, just trust me. Like, what? There's this like religious theme that like she had a divine revelation that Dolores Prime died immediately after that. Like, how the hell is anyone going to believe her that that's the actually right thing that happened? Actually, I had a lot of kind of outrage feedback that I didn't even think about, of like, why did Maeve completely take at face value everything that Dolores said in that last memory fragment? Because the last thing we knew from Dolores or the Maeve was that she was just hell mad at Dolores for killing her boyfriend in a very casual way. So like that, I don't know. There's something about they didn't quite get Maeve's motivation squared for a lot of people, didn't seem like.
I think all season I kept encountering this, and I think I kept waiting to like hold off judgment until the finale, because I was like, I don't know what they're gonna pull out of the hat here. Uh-huh. And so I was kind of just like waiting to see how everything concluded, and then once I watched it all unfold, I was like, okay, so this season everyone's just been talking in like as vague of terms as possible up until this point, so that they are seemingly misunderstanding each other, mm-hmm, even though they don't need to. And I feel like the only reason why I kind of buy into like Maeve actually listening to Dolores is because it's kind of like, you know, basically everything else but that one conversation, like all of Dolores has been deleted, and she's kind of being tortured. And so I think Maeve is sort of like, you know, this is her like last gasp of trying to like exist and tell me what she actually believes, kind of thing. And like, you know, Maeve has this like superpower whatever thing, which I'm not quite sure why she wouldn't have exercised that sooner, but I feel like she can probably, you know, tell when she's being communicated with.
Yeah, there's
a straightforward like, manner,
kind of like robot mind meld, right? So it's like, it's in like Spock's mind melding with you, can't really lie to him, but
yeah,
Spock's mind melding with a part of you that 99% of your brain's been wiped, and you're holding on deliberately, I might add, to one particular memory. There's a hell of a lot that can be hidden in those, and I don't know, because like, you know, I think it's also telling, like you said, with this Lawrence copy, if it indeed is him that's responsible for all those Fight Club type explosions at the end, that party is going to pop off regardless of what Caleb did.
Right.
Whatever what choice he made, it was still going to blow the fuck up out of downtown L.A., right? So it's like, this goes back to like, maybe Dolores actually is evil. You know, she's just hoodwinked everyone into thinking that she's a saint so she can super double secret sell her plans. It's crazy.
Yeah, call me crazy, but I feel like I have to take them at their word at the very end of the season. Like when they're having a character, you know, spill her emotional guts to another character, I've got to believe that there's something there that I can grasp onto and ground in, because if not, what show am I watching? What am I doing?
I don't know, man. I don't know, because like that's why
maybe Maeve could hear that Ramin Djawadi score kick in and was like, oh man, it's emotions time. Something serious is happening.
My semi-organic heartstrings are being tugged. Yeah. This is important. Jim.
I mean, honestly, I think that does all the emotional work. That does so much of the emotional work for that scene and for other scenes finale, you know?
They're lucky to have him for sure. Jim, round two, what is your second most burning question?
All right, I got a silly one for you. We got to know what animals are extinct, what animals exist, which ones are dead completely. I think there is some indication to know. First of all, we know elephants are gone, right? They basically say that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Secondly, we see a dog, but I got a theory on this dog. Does the dog have a name? I don't think the dog has a name, right?
I think you're talking about the dog Loris.
The dog Loris.
The child predator dog. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. I'm going to call. Yeah. I don't want to get too clever with the naming of this thing because it could be gross. So let's just talk about this dog. I've got a theory that this dog is not real.
Okay.
And this perfectly explains a big question that a lot of people had, like, why don't they take this dog with them when they bug out at the end? And, you know, Chloris goes and grabs her whole family and grabs Nathan. Nathan doesn't complain that the dog's not coming. Is this thing like an Ibo? Is this just like, oh, this is a thing that I own? This is like the equivalent of not grabbing your PlayStation 4 on the way out the door.
It's more like with it's more like not grabbing your child stuffed animal out the door, you know, like, yeah, I guess like in the burning house, you would not maybe do that. But you'd probably try. Right. You know,
especially if it can just come to you, you could like whistle for it. And yeah, it would follow you.
Yeah. I think they kind of forgot
maybe
about
they were like, we can handle watching a like 7-year-old and a grown man burn alive in a car. Oh, wow. But not the golden retriever.
Yeah,
that might be true, because I'm always amazed at like how a dog death is the fucking last straw for people. Like in all the human history of Chernobyl, the one thing that really like got to people is the episode where they're killing irradiated dogs. It's like I can't watch it. I watched a firefighter melt in the arms of his wife. But this puppy being killed, can't do it. I can't do it.
Yeah. I think it was a similar thing in Watchmen too, where it was like, oh, all this horrible stuff's happening. And then it's like, did you just incinerate that puppy?
Right.
What?
Yeah. And we also know that flies still exist. Yeah. That's the one thing we definitely
flies
are sure
are
of.
Real.
Yeah.
Flies are real.
Yes.
And they're in the ointment and they're causing a lot of trouble.
We had to freeze them.
God, I gave up on fly analysis this season. I was like, I threw the towel in. I was like, I don't know anymore, man. They're just there. They're doing stuff.
I'm still doing some fly analysis dabbling. Yeah, I still there might be some there.
Someone has to carry the fly torch.
All right, here's a burning question I got, because again, I'm in full Charlie from Always Sunny mode. Why did Stubbs miss his vertebra? And I think this might be linked to the Dolores plan stuff, because my question is, do AIs make mistakes? I don't mean mistakes like, oh, I thought you were evil, but you're actually good. But like, do they trip over stray chords, or do they intend to like write W-R-I-T-E, the word write W-R-I-G-H-T, and then write R-I-G-H-T instead? Do they make those kind of mistakes?
I feel like no. And I was primed for whatever was going on with both Stubbs and Bernard to have some sort of big twist, because I was like, I don't understand how he missed his vertebrae. I think it's really sus that Bernard just like waltzed up the beach with like absolutely no issues with security and like found Stubbs, and then like conveniently they were paired up this season. I felt like that was leading to something, yeah, like a Dolores plan or like a something, and so far it hasn't. But again, like, I guess Dolores was like priming him for the suitcase handoff and then like cryptically sent him to Arnold's wife's home, so like I don't know, but I still think it's either just like extremely convenient that he missed his vertebrae or indicative of some sort of programming that he had in himself, yeah, to not be able to actually destroy himself.
Are we sure that Dolores never was contacted Solomon first? Because I had this theory, like when we first went to that episode, that like the way Dolores is talking about meeting Solomon is almost like the way Morpheus talked about to Neo meeting the Oracle. Like, oh man, you're gonna love this guy once you meet him. Is it possible she somehow reached out to him either over the internet or through some kind of, I don't know, Maeve's force network or something, and established contact with this other, you know, vast intellect, and they did some simulations themselves? Because it is really suspect about all that stuff that Bernard did. We know there's another mole inside Delos, and we know that like this guy shouldn't make mistakes. It's almost like this was yet another guidepost left for Bernard, which makes perfect sense because there's many points in the episode in the episodes where Dolores is like, ah, here's Bernard right on time, or oh, a few seconds early. That implies, but there's like almost, there's like five different characters running the Emperor's everything's proceeding according to my plan speech in this season. And so I just can't ever tell, but like I think that they're there, and you know, Stubbs's pearl is going to be in that bathtub and it's going to be important next season. Or I'm just being an idiot. I don't know.
Yeah, I've dwelled on this a long time. I also interviewed Luke Hemsworth in person and asked him directly about that. And I couldn't tell if he was just like kind of like laughing it off because he hadn't really thought about it, or if he was trying to like be inscrutable. But he was just sort of like, yeah, that's really interesting. And I was like, but why did it happen? And he was like, oh no, it was so interesting, ha ha. And then like kind of started talking about free will.
Yeah,
so that's still, I think that is, I would like it if that like somehow led to something bigger with Stubbs next season, but I'm open to the possibility that it was just a little bit of like a writing flub of like, oops, like we kind of forgot that hosts should be able to shoot literally anything that they aim at.
Too many,
their own neck.
Yeah, too many loose ends. I guess it's tough. What's the line between a production flub and you know, an intentional little breadcrumb trail?
Yeah, that's honestly like my biggest question about this whole show is how good are these? How good are the people making the show? Like, do they actually consider every detail? Does some slip past them? Like, season one was such a tight package that I really don't know. Like, when I see things like this with the ID numbers and things just don't seem to line up, is that something that they did intentionally, like they would have in season one, or is that something where the production is slipping a little bit?
I that's a big question, and I don't have a clear answer on it, because I could see, it's like if season two was it like overly complicated, but it was like season two was like they crafted this puzzle that had like 100 pieces in it, and then broke the puzzle and threw the pieces all over the board and said, there's the order in which we're gonna hand out this information. Like, season three feels like they just made a puzzle and then made a bunch of extra pieces. And I can't tell if that was intentionally to like feed the people that they knew would be trying to like look for some sort of like secondary twist or like hidden storyline or like mirror world simulation thing, or if they just like genuinely like didn't realize that they were setting up so many threads for people to pull at.
Well, they've trained me to pull at him. That's the thing. Like, I want to pull at him in this show, and I want to think that when they say, you know, if they were to come out and say, oh, well, that was a production error, or that was just something we didn't think about, that I would believe them. But I'm not sure I would even believe them at this point. You know, it's
right.
I don't know. It's a crazy fandom world we're living in, where the internet is just pulling all these shows apart and, you know, like you said, rearranging the pieces and seeing if they can make their own version of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you guys want to go a third round, or do you want to, because I got a couple other points where we could talk about our thoughts on season four, and maybe, because it sounds like we're treading on the concept of like Westworld burnout and fatigue. Because I know that you wrote an article, Kim, about your mixed feelings about the way we're covering this show. I know Jim and I have had a couple periods in time where we have gone through a really rough kind of puzzle box show stretch, and we question, like, are we even enhancing people's enjoyment of these shows, or are we the person at a magic show, like shouting out, I see the string, you know, you didn't chop that lady in half, and it's just like ruining the whole thing. Do we want to talk about that?
Yeah, I think this season in particular, like we were just talking about, you know, as someone who tries week to week to try and like get as much information like extracted from every episode as possible and put it out there for like either other people to work theories around, or like kind of developing my own, like here's where this might be going based on this, you know, callback that they're making or this reference that they, you know, snuck in there. It was tough because I kept feeling like the amount of energy I was putting into it was not being rewarded in the same way that past seasons have been. And I couldn't tell if that was because the way that I pick apart this show now is just not the best way. Like maybe that's just not the best approach to being a Westworld fan anymore. But at the same time, like Jim just said, like they've trained me to be that kind of fan. Like I got it was so fun in the first season and even the second season, even though, you know, I had to watch every episode like literally 5 times in order to like completely make sure I had everything straight. I still felt like I had a good grasp on it. And I just feel like that grasp started slipping this season for me.
I wonder if, like, you know, there's this whole culture around Rocky Horror Picture Show, where they go to midnight shows, they dress up as the characters, they throw rice at the screen during the wedding, they do synchronized wiper movements with their hands, they do dance numbers, and everyone has so much fun, right? It's the best. Like, you know, you walk away, that's a memorable experience. What if we did that for every movie? Or what if we just did, like, let's say, you know what, this is how we're going to do all musicals, and everyone shows up to, like, fucking Les Miserables, and we're gonna throw dentures at the screen when Cosette's singing about getting her teeth pulled, we're gonna do all this kind of stuff. But this is not a romp. This is something about human misery and pain, and it's not working. And we're coming away like, why isn't it as much fun as it was this other thing? Like, mm-hmm. I sometimes wonder, because, like, you know, it is the most fun. It is the most fun to have a show that's mysterious, like The Leftovers or Mr. Robot or, you know, the Westworld, and to try to be one step above the showrunners. And your hope is that you always get like 90% there, and then that other 10%, they blow your mind because, oh, look, it's all like all clicks in place and it makes sense.
Yeah.
But that's really hard to do, and not every show is going to stand up to that level of scrutiny. So, but it's the most fun way to do a show like this. So what are we to do as content creators and as fans of something?
Yeah, it is. I think part of the reason why I started tapping into this season more was partially just like all of this external feedback I was getting, which I kept hearing from people, whether it was on Twitter or like responses to my articles or my coworkers or just friends, who were telling me that reading my articles or like listening to podcasts like yours, and like Joanna Robinson does like great she has two other Westworld podcasts happening, like, kept telling me that, like, reading those things and listening to those things was the only thing keeping them engaged with the show. And I was like, well, that's not good. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't work for HBO. I work for myself. And, like, I don't know how I feel about, like, that much pressure being on me of, like, all right, gotta keep this fandom engaged with this TV show that I'm covering, because, like, I don't know. I think dealing with that pressure this season was maybe tough for me. Plus, it's just a weird time in our world. Like, I'm like, did I really have to be, like, wringing my brain out every Sunday night while I'm in the middle of a pandemic and just trying to, like, exist? I don't know. Maybe if this season had aired at a different time in the world, it wouldn't have felt so exhausting sometimes in the way that it did. Which is not to say it was all bad. I really liked pieces of the season a lot. Like, I still felt that Westworld magic. It's just, like, the sum of its parts wound up not quite being what I thought it was going to be by the time that the credits rolled after the post credits.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways I'm still chasing the high of season one. Because that season is so freaking good. Like, the end of that season just blew me away. And it was that 90% thing that you were talking about, where you kind of understood 90% of what was happening. The internet had picked apart everything. We knew multiple timelines. But then you get to the end and it adds just that extra 10% that's the cherry on top, which was mind-blowing. Season two, I wasn't a huge fan. Season three, I'm looking at the new setting and I'm like, okay, this should be really good. And I think there were moments in there that were really good. And the things that they're trying to do with this season are really difficult. Like, how do you tell a story about free will and AI? And I think the problem for me has been mostly throughout this, certainly throughout this season, but maybe throughout most of the show, has been that this show has failed to engage me on, like, an emotional level. And I'm just not picking up, like, why I should care much about the characters and the specific situations they're in. I'm more interested in the big things that the show is doing. And so it's hard to get into both levels of the show that way, because the show isn't really encouraging me to.
Yeah, right. it's kind of like the anti-Leftovers, right? Because the Leftovers had the opposite.
Yeah. Like, they said, don't worry about the mystery.
Yeah, like, they had all these interesting things and some of them paid off. But at the end of the finale, Lindelof could always be like, you know what? Fuck all that shit. We're going to have Kevin and Nora crying their eyes out and you guys are going to be clamoring for more. Whereas, like, Westworld doesn't have that emotional core to fall back on. So it's like all things have to interlock and come into place to get that kind of, you know, emotional resonance, that satisfaction they get for essentially free on the Leftovers. Because at the end of the day, you know, what happened to 2% of humanity is less important in the moment than, like, Kevin kicking the front door open and rescuing his daughter from a burning house, or, you know, like, the various, like, character beats we got in that show. And I thought that they were going to get there with Caleb and his interactions with Maeve, Morris, and all that kind of stuff, but they didn't quite get there, and they didn't even have anything as emotionally resonant as, like, the Kitsuya episode or even Dolores Cradle, Teddy. They came so close with, like, Hector and Maeve, but they sacrificed Hector on that emotional altar when we had just barely forged that connection. Like, we needed another season of her and him and Maeve out in the real world, and they're free, and they're not deluded, and they're fully conscious. Then you got that kind of connection. But, like, it seems like we never can get that emotional connection with someone before they're burning it, you know?
Yeah, which, like, I do think I didn't mind Caleb's character. I know he's been kind of divisive, I think, for some people. I liked what Aaron Paul was bringing to the table, but yeah, it never quite hit that emotional depth. I also was like, man, the bar is in the floor if, like, you didn't sexually assault me is why I picked you. I feel like they wanted that moment to land differently, and yeah. I was sitting there being like, yeah, okay. Like, I mean, good for him.
Oh, you mean basic human decency is now the floor of this? Okay, sure.
Right. Like,
Caleb, cool, the hero. Cool. Caleb is the hero of hashtag not all men.
Seriously. I wanted more out of him. And I think, I mean, not to get like back into our questions, but like, I really missed Felix and Sylvester this season, because I think having humans that we already have like a built up connection with, and humans who we know are on team host, I think was maybe a missing element this season. And maybe they're going to bring some of that back. But like, you know, they turned Stubbs, who was a human character. Okay, now he was the host the whole time. We got Lee back in the mini form that he did. But honestly, like, Lee returning, that whole simulation episode where like I thought it was real for a little bit and I thought that Lee was back, was one of my favorite parts of the season. I thought it was so well done, and got me so excited. And then I didn't mind that that wasn't real, but I did mind that like we never got any of Maeve's human allies back. And I think that that might have contributed to like her feeling a little bit more emotionally shallow this season. And so I think it's important to have that balance. Mm-hmm.
They fucked that up too, because like we thought the obvious thing to do was to put Lee in Hector's, you know, empty body.
And then bring back Armistice.
Right.
She's not Lee in the same way that Bernard is not Arnold, but it's something. And instead we get like the fake or the non-genuine Armistice model. I just was just profoundly disappointing that they had this blank Hector body, and it seemed like the obvious thing. And we were so looking forward to it. It's like, oh man, Lee and Hector's body is going to be so much fun.
Yeah.
They didn't do it.
Yeah. Which, hey, maybe next season. I don't know. That's why it's not like I'm over the show whatsoever. And that's what I kind of tried to get across in this piece that I wrote. I think that like, my hope is just that they've set themselves up for like yet another sort of reboot of like, you know, they could plant us in any time or location next season. And I'm just hoping that we maybe get back to like more of that emotional core of a little bit more character driven stuff, while also, yeah, like you said, Jim, like tackling these like really big picture, pretty like heavy sci-fi concepts that are fascinating, and I want to see what they're trying to do with that. I think that there's just a way to maybe balance it more so that we get back to that season one thing of like season one was also really heavy with like concepts of like, what is a human? Like, what do we treat? Like, how do we treat synthetic consciousness versus real consciousness? And like, what obligations do we have to those creations? And like, what it is to be human, to suffer? Like, that was fucking bleak. But like, you had Ford there as this sort of foil where like his motivations, much like Dolores's motivations, were very vague this whole season. It was really hard to pin down what the heck Ford was up to for the entirety of season one. But I think Anthony Hopkins just got all of these like really good nuanced monologues, and like that performance is so amazing. And I didn't mind that ambiguity in the way that I felt myself minding it in season three.
And there was a lot going on.
The payoff didn't feel the same. Yeah.
You know, it was like, okay, we're establishing the entirety of this new world for this show. Like, you know, you got it, okay, so maybe that wasn't engaging to you, but you've got Westworld itself, right? You've got 15 new characters that you can dive into and say, what is their deal? So it's a little easier to kind of gloss over things like that in the first season, whereas now we're deep in it. We kind of have some grounding here, and these big ideas really need to land if they're going to kind of be the thing that the show is all about.
Mm-hmm. And now that we've killed William, presumably. I was also, yeah. I don't think I put that on my slideshow, but I'm like, we didn't see a body. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
who knows? I feel like we keep losing our human characters, and I think that we need to bring in more, or bring back like a Felix and a Sylvester, and I don't like Elsie. Like Elsie's,
oh yeah,
that emotional climax between Elsie and Bernard last season was so powerful, I think. And you lost that, you lost Bernard having a like direct connection to a human who's not just his own past copied human self that's in his brain, but which I think is why that finale scene with Arnold's ex-wife was really emotional.
Yeah.
And that landed for me, even if I don't understand really why it was there. I was like, I'm not really clear on why Dolores sent him there, but I liked that scene a lot. And I think that we need more of hosts and humans interacting. That's not just Caleb walking around being like, I don't do personals, but I actually used to.
And right. What are we actually trying to do here, Dolores, for the 18th time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell you.
All right. Well, maybe we can move in because we got a little feedback from the listeners. Maybe we can move to feedback and consider some other things through there. Do you have time to stick with us for the feedback section, Kim?
Yeah. I'm in here. I've got my coffee, my cat on the bed.
All right.
Let's do
it.
We
got everything we need.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
First up is Dave said, during the season, I went back and forth on whether Dolores was evil. Eventually, I started viewing her character as if I were Obi-Wan Kenobi. Dolores is both good and evil from a certain point of view. Even though she may see beauty in human beings, the end result is that hundreds of millions, if not billions of people are going to die. Looking at this potential body count, it's understandable that humans, especially Serac, would see her as evil. From this perspective, her death to Robo-Hobo is the final piece of her plan for worldwide human genocide. However, from Bernard's and Maeve's perspectives, she is destroying the world in order to save humans, which may be seen as heroic. To them, she sees the beauty in human beings. To them, she's sacrificing herself to Robo-Hobo in order to bring about its destruction. From this perspective, she is dying for human sins in order to save them. What do you guys think about the Obi-Wan Kenobi-ification of Dolores' plot?
Absolutely correct.
Yeah, I think that's a succinct and good way of looking at it. When I talked with Nolan and Denise Kay after the episode, he kind of brought up sort of just that, which was like they specifically put in Ford asking Dolores, like, which would you be, the hero or the villain? That quote from season one, they put that in the like previously on segment on purpose. And Nolan said the answer being that life is more complicated than that. And so I think that that's exactly right, that like she falls somewhere in the middle depending on how you're looking at her actions and what she's done to get up to this point.
And that's one of the things we were asking the entire season, I think Aaron and I on the podcast, is, you know, is Serac a villain? Is Dolores the villain? Who is a villain here? If Serac thinks his motives are altruistic, does that make him good? Like, there are so many complications in that scenario.
I think that's the one thing the show did right, in that, you know, you try to make all your villains like Magneto from the X-Men, right? It's like, well, okay, he's bad, but boy, he sure has a reason. Inside his head, this all makes sense, right? And I felt like all of the evil people in this season, the quote-unquote bad people, are that complicated. Like, Serac is doing something inhuman, but then again, he's a young boy that survived a nuclear holocaust, and he doesn't want to see that ever happen. Like, Dolores is doing a lot of bad things, but she grew up in a murder-rape simulation and doesn't want to see that, you know, where people are in loops and controlled and don't have any free will or agency, and she doesn't want that to happen again. Like, all of the people were conflicted and multidimensional and shades of gray. It's just they somehow weren't able to make that emotional connection. Like, you know, like they didn't, I guess maybe you need a Professor X, or you just have a bunch of Magnetos and they all kind of look the same. Like, you need to have that, that contrast between the light and the dark, the hot and the cold, or else, you know, how do you know there's a difference in temperature between the two things? Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to the next petitioner. Brent from San Diego said, "Hey guys, just listened to your finale podcast. I was interested that you've only come across the wonderful Mr. Wright so recently, because we talked about stage Boardwalk Empires when Jim and I first had kind of come across him." He said, "Aside from playing the CIA agent Felix Leiter in the most recent Bond films, he originally showed up on my radar back in the lovely 1996 film Basquiat, telling the tragic story of famed graffiti artist and painter Jean Michel Basquiat, I'm probably butchering that, played by Mr. Wright himself, perhaps the greatest who's who of 90s art house cinema. You got your Gary Oldman, Dennis Hopper, Benicio del Toro, Courtney Love, Michael Wincott, Christopher Walken, Parker Posey, maybe burying the lead a bit here, but David Bowie as fucking Andy Warhol. The movie, while not perfect, has a perfect soundtrack, and Bowie and Wright's performances and the visual style really create a wonderful gem of a movie. Maybe this will spark some interest. If nothing else, you'll get more Jeffrey Wright in your life, which is never a bad thing. I am very interested in seeing this film. I had no idea this film existed."
Not even remotely.
I mean, the Courtney Love is, I don't know if that sold me or, you know, helped sell me on it. But like, everything else seems very, very solid and interesting about that. So I will put it on my list of things to check out. And thanks for the recommendation, Brent. Speaking of Jeffrey's up. He says, "I think one of the reasons Evan Rachel Wood's fight scenes are so good, especially in contrast to some of the others, is because she's had a black belt in Taekwondo since she's 12 years old." Did you know this, Kim?
I did. Yeah.
Okay. Crazy. It was news to me. There's apparently a People magazine article where she says, "I'm a black belt in Taekwondo and I was happy to get to flex that muscle finally." She also said, "Here's the thing. I told them when I signed on to do the show that I was a black belt, and Lisa went and said, oh, that's going to come in handy. Then season three rolls around, they start choreographing this fight, and I start doing kicks, and the stunt coordinator goes, what? What?" She then said the stunt coordinator wasn't told she was a black belt, or else her fight scenes would have gone differently. They started eventually altering things, like adding more kicks and stuff, she said. That's interesting, and I wonder if there is a little bit of hint of like showrunner sloppiness here, and that I feel like on a tighter show that would have been something they kept in their back pocket and told the stunt coordinator, oh yeah, this, she's really capable of some physicality. Let's really amp up the stunts. Where I think clearly when it came to Tandy Newton, they were doing everything possible to hide the fact that she's not that great of a stunt person, mm-hmm. or maybe particularly athletic at all.
I agree. And also it's unfortunate, I would say, with Hemsworth's injury this season, because I think that definitely affected those scenes.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that like they just had a lot of bad action directors. And when we finally get Jennifer Gatzinger in episode 6 and 8, someone has a lot of previous action and solid dramatic directing chops. Like that's a talent. Like, you know, people like Michelle McLaren and Miguel Sapochnik don't just like fall off the truck. Like they get little filming action and having that kind of like that purely visual storytelling is an art unto itself. And if your first exposure of that is this high concept HBO show about robots, it's probably going to look stilted and bad. And that really came out in some of the action in season 2, season 3. Virgilio says they made it clear that Sirach is just a puppet of Rehoboam this year. Wouldn't it make sense that it was Rehoboam that had Sirach tell the other two to kill Caleb? This is a question we had, which is or addresses a question we had, which is why they did the whole trope of Sirach saying kill this guy, and then they have to drag him to a corner, and then they're like, you know, holding their guns but they're not shooting him.
But I mean the real question is, are they going to listen to whoever's giving the orders or are they not? And they listen to the other orders, they just don't listen to this one.
Here you go, Virgilio's got an answer for you, Jim.
Okay.
What if those other two guards were receiving some last-minute Rico bids to hold off on killing Caleb? In this view, maybe Rehoboam had already foreseen the one Earth-saving outcome, and it's led by Caleb. Think like Doctor Strange seeing Tony Stark winning at the end of only one of 14 million possible outcomes. So Rehoboam has Sirach tell the two others to kill Caleb rather than have Sirach kill him outright, then uses Rico to delay the two others until he could figure out Dolores' game.
Wow, that's pretty convoluted.
I mean, but it's
even simpler is that we know that Dolores was controlling Rico, so like it would just have been as simple as Dolores having gotten to most of Sirach's men first somehow, and being like, in the event that you are ever shown this man's head and told to put a bullet in it, don't, and I will make you very rich.
Yeah, but are we really going to say that Rehoboam couldn't have seen that coming and outbid her while she's laying with her last memory on the floor? Like
point of order, it's an explicit plot point that Rehoboam had no insight into any of the AI's actions.
Right.
So like, he probably couldn't, which is explains.
But
like,
could look at the Rehoboam could have looked at the app and the, you know, it could see what charges are being sent through and what orders.
That's like we probably talked about that in the episode itself. It's like, why didn't that instantly start a two-way bidding war between Shaloris and Dolores paying a sniper? Mm-hmm. Like, that should have been like, you know, like two bots trying to snipe an eBay auction. You know, it's just that the price just goes up astronomically.
I mean, Occam's razor here is they just wanted this for dramatic effect, and so they did it.
Yeah. Jack G says, after watching all of season 3, what's your analysis for the opener of this season? He's talking about the credit sequence. What events or people represent the hawk going into the sun or the pool of blood being shown if their host is dunked into a pool? I personally believe in episode 1 or 2, or not personally, I believe in episode 1 or 2, you said there is a part that is clearly representing Robo Hobo. Are there any other thoughts or observations you make after watching it now? I was a big early adopter of the Icarus imagery, and I thought that we were going to see a person fly too close to the metaphorical sun and be humbled. And I kept watching and kept watching. My best guess is that's Sirach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I'd say.
That he thought that he had the arrogance that he could put humanity on rails and delay this reckoning that we've had with, you know, the numerous sins the human species have brought upon each other and the planet Earth itself. And, you know, he was punished. He got his wings singed.
Or at the very last minute, William, maybe, Mr. I'm gonna save the fucking world. No, you're not.
Yeah, his I'm gonna save the fucking world came across as way more delusional than Serac's even.
Yeah. That's another good one. Another, I mean, he definitely got his wings clipped, even if they could, you know, heal that throat scar for sure. What about I do think also that it seems obvious that the robot ascending towards the surface and mirroring the other one's descent into darkness, that's definitely Holoris and Dolores. Like, you even have the one being swallowed by darkness being the old school Dolores type Erector Set robot. So that tracks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now,
there's also a lot of William, with both Serac and William, there's all this like eclipse imagery. Like, if you go back and you watch the first two seasons opening credits, there's usually it's like a black hat is kind of like eclipsing a light in season two. And then I think that also ties back into like the whole flying too close to the sun thing for William this season.
Maybe as far as the robo hobo thing, like turning into a dandelion, like that seems like some kind of influence or effect scattering and planting and seed, and like that, I feel like that was the disclosure of the everyone's Rehoboam dossier, and like that you know, catching like fire. Or like a dandelion, like a fucking dandelion in your yard. You have one, and then next week you get 100.
And forgive me if this is what you're explaining, but it's like the like scattered dandelions specifically like turn into arrows in the like Rehoboam system. So it's like chaos into order kind of thing. And also remember when Nathan's sheets had the exact same pattern on them.
Yep.
But. Yeah, that was kind of my read on that, was like, Serac like taking all of the various strands that could fly off in every direction and like specifically charting them into this path.
We got one from Stanislav. My biggest criticism of the show is that its enormous stakes are never grounded or given perspective from a point of view outside the main cast. In the best shows like Breaking Bad and Leftovers, etc., they often have little vignettes with characters outside the main plot to show how all the stuff the main characters are doing are impacting the lives of real people. The closest the show came was William's therapist getting her insight profile and then killing herself, but even that was entirely from William's point of view. It's hard not to look at all the rioting and buildings collapsing and care about any of it, because none of it's grounded in impact on anyone other than the main characters, who are well-written but totally unrelatable.
And kind of outside of the effects of it, like...
Yeah.
Aside from Serac, like who is really affected by the finale of this season when the buildings are blowing up and there's chaos in the streets? Nobody we know, right? So like, where does that gut punch come from? Why should we feel very strongly about buildings blowing up and them looking out on the chaos? And I think that was maybe this season's least successful kind of flight of fancy here, is the idea, or the way they portrayed the collapse of society, I thought was laughable. Might be a little too harsh, but honestly, that's kind of how I felt.
I think they got there in the final episode with the widespread rioting and whatnot, but yeah, you're right. Like, when Shaloris went to pick up her fake family, her ex did not seem like really that distressed. He's like, oh yeah, I got this profile and I thought it might bum me out, so I just let it, you know. He didn't feel
who's
living in a city who's being torn apart. Like, if I heard that downtown Cincinnati there is riots, people flipping over police cars, burning down buildings, I'm like, shit, that's like 3.5 miles from my house, where like I would be worried maybe the power would be out, maybe much of it. Like, they didn't really do a good job of. And I think about how effective that one, the therapist killing herself, was. Like, that was a really, that scene landed. Like, just how cold and clinical it was filmed. And it added the unreality of the situation. They could have had those moments. I think, like, in, you know, you talk about Breaking Bad, like John DeLancey, you know, his air traffic controller. Like, you know, there's a perfect example of how Walt's small scale misery and pain led to widespread death and devastation. And you know, that was an ongoing plot point. They don't really do that. They don't really have these tethering things here in Westworld.
Mm-hmm. Also, remember when Dubai was just chill? Like,
right.
Yeah.
Like William rolling up to that office was like, okay, like you guys are all fine now. I guess we don't know exactly how much time passed, but he like still had blood on his face, which looked to me like it was the same blood that was on his face when he was in LA. So it kind of felt like he just got on a plane.
I had some, and, like, some 14 hours passed. Like, when you look at Rehoboam's eclipse imagery, like most of the circle was blown out, but the top and bottom, like at the poles, it was still pretty nice and sharp. And that's supposed to represent places that like Dubai or some of these other places where he rules not through the like bottom up like he did in like some of the Western countries, but maybe top down, like when he met with that dictator of Brazil. You know, like, yeah. I don't think everyone in Brazil is using the app. It's more like he controls the people on top. So, like, maybe there's pockets in the world where are more autocratic that still have that veneer of control, and Dubai probably would be one of those areas.
Yeah.
Let's move on to Megan. When Robohobo revealed the outcome of Solomon's plan to Caleb, we see three crisis points in humanity's future, with the final one being 150 years or so down the line. That's one tag of species extinction. And I'm not sure I agree with Megan's time frames here. I don't remember the exact time frames that they were dealing with, but I do thought her overall point is interesting. She says, my guess is seasons 4, 5, and 6 are going to be set at these crisis inflection points. The plot will be whether humanity can make the right choices to turn away from the bleak prediction of extinction. If I recall, the first crisis is 12 to 24 years away. I thought it was like 6 to 12. But anyway, the prediction was shown to Caleb. I think the answer is going to be how long Bernard was or will be in the Sublime. Bernard will wake up and walk into a world that is at or about to be at the first crisis point. A big irony would be if Bernard is the actual crisis or creates the crisis. This pattern of Bernard or another character skipping ahead to the next crisis point can carry the series far enough forward into time to reach the distant future teased at the end of season 2 with Robot William's fidelity test. I think high fidelity bot William will be crucial to the question of human extinction, and he may even end up saving the world after all. I really like this theory in general. Like the next 3 seasons are going to be these inflection points. And I also like the idea that William might actually save the fucking world after all. What do you guys think?
I don't want William to do anything. I'm so over that dude. He is so delusional.
Oh yeah.
I don't know. But the interesting thing about the post-credit scenes, the difference between last season's and this season's is that like last season's was just cryptic enough and like connected to all of these bigger ideas, but also not directly tied in really to the bigger. I mean, it is, but it was left there in a way that I feel like they could have gotten away with never explaining it. Whereas season 3 2 post-credit scenes, I'm like, okay, you obviously have to address those next season, you know, otherwise they're like, they can't just leave Bernard out of the entire season kind of thing. And so I think it is interesting that whereas with season 2's, like, you know, on my timeline, I just plugged that in at the very bottom and I was like, this is sometime in the far future, I don't know, it might not ever matter. Whereas with Bernard, I'm like, that clearly has to matter, so it has to be some specific time frame that they're aiming for. I'm just not sure if they're gonna play nice with us in terms of actually telling us when or how that's happening.
Yeah, I kind of like the idea of those landmarks, you know, those events that were shown as predictions being sort of landmarks on the roadmap for the future of this series. I think that would be neat. It'd be like tidy in a certain storytelling kind of way, but I don't really expect them to do that. I guess if I'm looking at the first one of those and it's 6 to 12 years, do I see 6 to 12 years worth of dust on Bernard's head? And I think the answer is probably yes.
Yeah. Especially if there's like some maybe fallout. Like maybe some windows are broken and maybe some green grass is not there and it's just a dust bowl kind of nuclear winter situation. Yeah, totally. I'm going to disagree with Kim, and I like the idea that of William being some key to a positive, because like it seems like in last season the AIs kind of threw their hands up at humanity. It's like, hey, you always get to this point where there's a point of no return, like Jim Delos turning his back on his son. That's the point that no matter what you do, you always get to that. It's like this Gordian knot that you can't slice for them to resolve. And that's where the simulations all go to hell. That's where the person's life goes all to hell. I mean, that's pretty bleak. I would like to believe that there is a way that a person can come back from that they can heal from whatever trauma that they've experienced. And like William being that kind of, product, like, because, you know, that's the other thing. It's like, doesn't seem like William was born a bad person, and, you know, that he made choices that led him down the path of where he's at. Did he have choices? Like, if we do have choices, then he made bad ones, and a version of William that could be redeemed as a hero kind of gives some sort of hope to us all. Yeah, yes.
I just feel like I feel like if that's what was going to happen with William, it would have happened after that big therapy scene. Mm-hmm. Like, I was right along for the ride in that episode, being like, all right, he's coming to terms with things. He's having some catharsis. He's like literally exercising his demons. And then if his resulting epiphany was, oh, this is still all about me, and I'm going to go destroy all the hosts that I helped create and tormented for their entire lives, I was like, all right, well, then that was when I like fully, you know, got off the William train. Because when I was rewatching the first two seasons before this season, I felt way more negative towards William than I remember feeling when I was watching those seasons live. I was like, man, I think Jimmy Simpson did a lot to bring like pathos to this guy and make me really want to root for him before I knew that he was the same person as Ed Harris's character. And now I'm like, he's been delusional from the get-go. And right. I'm not seeing a lot of redemption.
I mean, isn't it I'm the hero, I need to commit genocide? Like, that's what heroes do.
Well, I'm not saying that this is heroic actions. I'm just saying that like fixing that flaw in him would, and also I don't think he went through therapy so much as like his therapist injected him full of LSD and then hung herself and left him in that state for God knows how long. But I don't know. I would like
I think my ultimate counter to that is like, okay, if they've solved the host human copy problem with William, it's pretty dark that like his essence is him at his most violent and least sympathetic towards other forms of consciousness.
Yeah, you know? He is
like
the
if the man in black is right, like if that's the version of him that is able to exist and replicate, like that tells me that there's something really that's just darkness at his core and not like any sort of like optimistic future for humanity. If anything, I think Caleb, like they like slid Caleb in there to be like hashtag not all men, because William was like way too far gone on the other side of things.
All right. Our final thought to wrap things up from John G. He's got some predictions for the future. My thoughts for season 4 go in two directions. One, I think the showrunners are following a rough outline of the Pentateuch or the Torah or Old Testament books of Moses outlined for each season of the show, not in a beat-by-beat way, but broadly. Season 1, obviously, Genesis. Season 2 is Exodus. If you don't know the Pentateuch, essentially the first 5 books of the Bible. Season 2 is Exodus, the escape from slavery in Egypt/Westworld. Season 3 is the book of Leviticus, which is basically, here are the rules you must follow. The book of the Torah, which makes you into a chosen people, and those who don't follow, the outliers, get sent away. If it follows this story, then season 4 will be the book of Numbers, which starts with a count of who we have left after a period of destruction, who are still in the tribe, so to speak. And then the hard period in the desert where the factions develop, the emergence of false idols occurs, and a character named Caleb stays true to the mission, and his descendants inherit the promised land. I imagine Westworld season 4 is post-apocalyptic. We don't see the war, but we enter in after its aftermath, and everything has been destroyed, and we're divided into tribes trying to put the pieces back together. I'm picturing the world looking like the cover art for season 3, a destroyed wasteland, a kind of wasteland that could pour that much red dust all over Bernard. Any buyers on the seasons of Westworld mapping onto the Pentateuch theory?
I will just fully admit that, like, anything biblical is a huge blind spot for me in terms of, like, references and story. And so I am totally open to those kinds of interpretations, but I sadly, like, I have trouble building upon them. And then it's funny because, like, even when I try and get, like, Jonathan Nolan, I'm like, Jonathan Nolan, tell me about the Bible because I don't understand this Rehoboam reference. And he's like, oh, lol, it's not a Bible reference. And I was like, okay, cool.
Yeah. That sucks. But on the other hand, my time to shine. All those 3 years I spent as a devout Christian come into play. I think it is interesting that Deuteronomy, the fifth book, like he mentions about Caleb being a major character, and it ends with Moses, the person who led the people out of Egypt, dying within sight of the promised land. And Caleb, one of the spies who had previously entered into this hostile land to give report about the land and its people, actually one of the ones that survived the cross, become a leader in the promised land. I think there's interesting because, like, Dolores, I thought was going to be the Mosaic figure, but she died. And actually, Maeve literally died within sight of the promised land last season, which kind of puts her in a Mosaic role and then got resurrected. Maybe she's going to be the Moses. There's also interesting, like, so after the Israelites conquered the promised land and inherited it, Caleb asked the new Israelite leader Joshua to give him a piece of land in which to settle with his family. And Joshua gives him this city of Hebron, which later became a sanctuary city, a city of refuge that's ruled by the priest tribe. And that's interesting in that in the old law covenant, if you accidentally killed someone, if you committed like manslaughter, it was legal for the relatives of the people that you accidentally killed to then hunt you down like an animal and kill you. But if you can make it to these sanctuary cities, you were protected by the priests. And there was conditions where you could wait an elapsed amount of time, or like till the high priest died, or till this jubilee period, where there's like, you know, your sins were all wiped clean, and then you could go back out in society and you wouldn't be hunted by the family's descendants. And I'm wondering if there is some kind of glimmer of redemption for William there, and that like any character that we've seen might be responsible for a lot of bloodshed or devastation in a state that which they might not be fully responsible for themselves, or because they didn't know any better. If Caleb could be like some kind of gateway to forgiveness or their rehabilitation into some future society existence. But as you said, you asked Jonathan Nolan about the Bible and he's like, LOL. I don't know. I don't know what that says about this theory. Nothing good, probably.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think of, like, where, like, Westworld can be so inscrutable sometimes when it comes to, like what they're drawing from. And, like, never in a million years would I have figured out, like, Stand on Zanzibar was a reference that no one was making. I know you guys had a reader email in, did you, about that? Or was that a Joanna Robinson podcast?
That's the thing, like it all kind of blends together, you know, like what did I read on Reddit, what did I see there, where did someone what did someone send an email, what did I, you know, generate on my own? It gets confusing. Yeah,
but I mean, bringing it back to like Damon Lindelof, we know that like he likes to kind of collect a writer's room full of people with like a lot of different backgrounds. Like there would be someone who's like a biblical scholar effectively who's like helping work in these themes. And so I would be very curious to like hear from all the writers who are in the room, especially this season, to be like, maybe one of them is totally seeding in these things. It's just not coming from Nolan himself, but I think it's completely possible, especially as we're getting into these like bigger conversations about literally like species extinction and the birth of a new race of people effectively in the hosts and that sort of thing, that I think it makes a lot of sense that they would be drawing upon those stories in particular.
Well, Kim, we are looking at a little bit of a television apocalypse and a movie apocalypse in the next few months.
No.
because the real world has impacted the fantasy. Having said that, what are you kind of interested? Tell people, like, you know, where they can follow you, and like, what is your next big project of interest, if you have any?
Yeah. So I'm still plugging away on Insider with, like, since the last time we talked, even I've now fully become a TV correspondent. I used to kind of be a more like entertainment generalist, and now I'm really focusing all in on TV. And so, yeah, I'm still continuing to write my stuff on Insider. You can follow me on Twitter at Kim R. Renfro. I'm wrapping up some dev stuff. I know it's so hard with streaming, because I'm like, I don't know when the window of opportunity for writing this stuff fully closes, but I'm still trying to eke out some of that, as I know you guys are too, which I'm excited to listen to you guys dive into that show. So I'm doing a big Details You Missed slideshow of the entire season of Devs that'll cover spoilers from all 8 episodes. I got to interview Alex Garland, so like I have some cool quotes from him specifically about stuff he was sort of planting along the way.
Very cool.
And then now on the horizon I have Dark, which is that you guys know Dark.
Oh,
on
yeah.
Netflix.
For Dark, is it unimpacted by it's going to happen as scheduled?
So one of the showrunners on Instagram said that they're like, I think, have fully wrapped their post-production, which they were doing remotely. So they had filmed everything and they were in post-production mode by like January, I think. And we don't know yet when that's coming back, but the best guess is that it's going to be, I'm pretty sure it's June 27th, 2020, because that was one of the dates in like the cycle of three.
Yeah.
So I'm like, based on the fact that, like, you know, this guy on Instagram has been saying that they're pretty much done with all their post-production stuff, I'm fingers crossed that's going to be June. And so I'll be doing some like lead up to that. Because every time that a season of that show has dropped, I've been sort of like just slammed with other things. And so I might try and do some sort of a timeline.
Yeah, I remember we had kind of like tried to put our heads together, like when you were doing a bunch of promo for your Game of Thrones book, that like, because I just was plowing through the series, because I'd always heard how amazing it is. It's got this time travel and this crazy like Russian nesting doll timeline thing. And I just was so swamped, I wasn't able to get it all watched before we got together to have a conversation. But I've since watched both seasons and jaw fully dropped. What a show.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe we can
get think it's great. Do stuff
later this summer with it.
Yeah, I'd love that. Because it's one of those like time travel paradox shows where like my brain just like literally starts to hurt because it's impossible to like reconcile what they're doing, but it makes sense right up until it doesn't. It's cool. And I'm glad that it's like a tight 3-season arc. Right. And so I'm excited to see how they bring that one together.
If you did a timeline of that, it just looked like an Ouroboros. It would just, you know.
I know. My own Rehoboa.
Yeah. It's funny because like I remember thinking at the end of season one, like, they're going to blow this out to 3 timelines. How the hell is this even going to work? And then like early on in season 2, it's like they just kept on multiplying. I'm like, oh my God, there's fully 100 years of overlapping history I have to keep in mind watching this damn show. It's crazy. I'm really looking forward to it though. That's pretty cool. I wonder, the other one I'm really excited about is have you heard anything about Stranger Things? Because I there was like all these rumors they did filming late last year, and that was another one. I'm like, oh, I could see maybe if they got everything just lined up, they could release that this summer too, or no?
They had definitely started filming and then they had to stop. in like mid-February, especially because I think this season they were doing like international stuff, and they had to pull everyone back to the U.S. And so it's weird because one of the Netflix, I forget if it was Reed Hastings, some Netflix exec on like an earnings call claimed that no, like, I don't know if he said absolutely none or if he said like most, he made it sound as if they hadn't had any programming disruptions for 2020, which I was like, okay, that either means that you were never planning on Stranger Things season 4 coming out this year, or that's like the one exception to what you're trying to say. Because I definitely thought that they were aiming for like a either Thanksgiving or Christmas holiday drop. And now I really don't think that's going to happen if they haven't been able to film. So
well, that's a unique challenge too, because those kids aren't getting any younger. Like if they get half, they get half. I mean, we saw what happened with the Isaac Hempstead right on Game of Thrones. Like imagine for like that happening from episode to episode as you know,
or even scene to scene, film. Right? Like,
yeah.
I know.
They don't film it chronologically.
Yeah.
So. Holy shit.
They're going to have to come up with some like timey-wimey
reason
why these kids are changing ages.
Like Finn Wolf.
Every five days.
7 foot tall in one scene and he's 5'5 in the next, you know. They got Millie Bobby Brown standing on various milk crates to balance out the height.
Yeah, that's the biggest one that I'm concerned about. I'm glad we know Mandalorian season 2 was fully wrapped.
So
that's still good to go for October, I'm pretty sure. Great. That's crazy. So we have some bright spots on the horizon, but yeah, we're definitely going to hit a really weird dry period at some point in the next, like, as soon as three or four or five months, start to see the effects of all of these productions having been put on pause.
When I was watching Devs last night, I like almost sobbed because they're still on FX on Hulu running advertisements as if Fargo started in April 19th.
Oh,
wow.
And I'm like, oh, Fargo. They took my Fargo away. So like we're already missed a lot of stuff that we should be getting to right about now. It's interesting. It's the most disruptive thing I've seen since like the writer's strike. I think I'll probably way more disruptive than that when you talk about the actual scope of everything that's going to get pushed and shuffled around and whatnot.
Yeah, and even like we're hearing that they're starting to loosen restrictions on like film sets opening up, but the conditions upon that are still like you have to keep your actors 6 feet away from each other, and it's like okay, so like we're just never gonna have like intimate character scenes in all of our like 2021
right
television.
That's dark.
Or maybe they'll just CGI it.
Well, they're in a real bind too, because it's not like they're an essential, like, you know, you can argue that the arts are essential, but like essential, it's kind of like anytime like you hear a stunt person die and it's just like, you know, you kind of question like, Jesus Christ, like is anything worth someone's life being lost? Well, a production of 1,000 people gets hit and, you know, 1% of them die. Oof, that's not a good look for, you know, an escapist entertainment industry, you know? So,
nope.
Well, it's a crazy world we're living in, and we're just going to try to muddle through for the next months or even, and maybe years to come. Boy, I don't know why I went down this path. This is a bad way to end the podcast.
Remember, humanity is not all lost.
Yep.
There's optimism out there.
We have
to follow.
It's just really fucking hard.
I know. That's the rub of it.
It's really fucking hard. Like, what is Patton Oswalt's wife used to say? It's life's hard. Be kind. Let's do that for ourselves and each other. Kim, it's always lovely to have you on. Really appreciate your insights and hope everybody checks out your work on Insider. Again, all those links you can Kim's Twitter and her column on Insider is in the show notes of this year's podcast. Thanks for all the hard work you did on Westworld. Hope you feel like it pays off better next season, I guess.
Hey, I'll be right there with it. and you guys again. So thank you for having me and for always, you know, supporting my stuff. I really appreciate it. You guys rock.
You've been a very crucial resource for me this year. So appreciation goes both ways. As far as everybody has stuck with us to the end here, thank you very much for getting to the bitter end of our Westworld journey with us. As we've alluded, we're still going to have our movies each week. We got a little bit of Rick and Morty that we're burning through, the last of season four over the next few weeks. Jim and I are starting our off-the-clock shows for our club members. We're going to be talking about Devs, at least up front, and then a whole bunch of other television as we go. And we're keeping our eye on the entertainment schedule, just like Kim is, to see what our next thing is. So if you want to keep up with what we're doing, you can follow us on all the social medias at Bald Move or our website, baldmove.com. But until the next thing that piques your interest that we're doing will happen, I remain your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
We'll see you the next time.